This is Jerry Parkoff speaking, and I'm going to give you a rendition of a talk that I gave last night on Friday night, Shabbos, which was Beis Adar of the year Tafshin Nun Ches, commemorating the 15th yahrzeit of my father-in-law, Harav Zichrono Levracha. And I began by pointing out that we're planning to send our daughter Bela to Machon Gold next year in Yerushalayim. And I addressed my remarks at that time to Bela, that at a yahrzeit we're reaching back to a previous generation, namely to you, Bela's grandfather, who was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael, and at the same time we're reaching out into the future. And God willing, the future for us is Bela. And both your grandfather and you are now linked together with Eretz Yisrael. You've been there for a summer, and now you're going to spend another year there, and the link will get stronger and stronger. Your grandfather was a great, great lover of Eretz Yisrael, and because of that, two of his sons are now living in Israel, and hopefully more and more of his children will get over there. In any event, tonight I'm going to talk about Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, but I want to put the discussion into a more general context, namely what Kedusha itself is. But I'd like to begin with a story about my Aunt Ruthie. Because my Aunt Ruthie is my mother's sister. I just happened to speak to her this week. And, you know, you live so long in an Orthodox religious community, and you sort of forget what things were like, even if you had known what they were like at one time in your life. And I really forgot. And I said, Ruthie, you know, you grew up in an Orthodox home, didn't you? I mean, Grandma and Grandpa, they kept Shabbos. And she says, yeah, sure. So I asked her, like, what happened? And she, you know, out of six children did not remain religious. So she gave me three incidents right off the bat. Number one, that all school trips were on Shabbos. And she complained bitterly that she never went to the Statue of Liberty until the age of 21. And she was very upset about that. And furthermore, her friends would go to the movies on Shabbos. And she, in order to participate, would have to buy the ticket on Friday and then go with them on Shabbos. She resented this very much. And finally, there was one Shabbos afternoon, she went over to some friends. She was fleishig because she obviously had lunch at home, regular Shabbos lunch, which was fleishig. And the friends were eating ice cream, and when she said she couldn't eat ice cream because she was fleishig, the parents of her friend berated her and mocked her, you know, made fun of her that she was still keeping kosher. They had no religious friends, or very few it seems. And it just seems that they themselves were unable, they didn't understand Shabbos, they didn't understand the Torah or Shabbos enough to deal with the secular culture. And in my opinion, the real problem goes back one generation further. In other words, my grandparents' generation, which seems to have been not unwilling, but certainly unable to deal with the secular culture at the time, for whatever reasons, whether the pressures were economic or even linguistic, that they just couldn't get the ideas out into the English language, but, you know, maybe in Yiddish they could have, or I don't know if that was the problem, but they couldn't deal with the secular culture. They didn't set up schools fast enough. They didn't have the spokesman that we have today who can speak eloquently in English about the insights and secrets of the Torah, the treasures of the Torah, which is so readily available in in today's world at the late 20th century. In any event, I mention this story because of the idea of restrictions. The idea of restriction, my Aunt Ruthie resented it tremendously, and she resented the Jewish religion tremendously because of these restrictions, which she didn't comprehend, couldn't put into any reasonable context. I think this really typified an entire generation. We have to remember that this past generation, they were as smart as we were, and maybe even smarter. I know who my uncles were, and these were very, very capable people. One of my uncles runs a very large corrugated factory now, that which my grandfather began, and it's a major enterprise. So we certainly can't discount them on the basis of ability or intellect. In any event, the idea of restriction will be relevant as we proceed to analyze what Kedusha means. It's very hard to understand Kedusha in a generic sense. And then the question is, do we look for one meaning of Kedusha and simply apply it to various situations? And particularly, I want to apply Kedusha to the areas of Kedushat HaGuf, which is the holiness or Kedusha of the individual, and then Kedushat HaZman, the holiness of time, and Kedushat HaMakom, the holiness of place. If you want to put that in cosmic terms and in Star Wars terms, if you will, we're talking about the Kedusha of space and time and the individual within that framework. So the question is, can we take one basic meaning of Kedusha and apply it to all of these various situations, or do we say no, there's no single root meaning to the idea, but only a family of meanings or a cluster of concepts that are somehow related? So in any event, although the idea of cluster of concepts became very popular about 30 years ago, maybe 40 years ago, with Wittgenstein and the English philosophers of the mid-20th century, I still prefer initially to begin with the more simple method, thinking that maybe there's just one key idea that we can apply to all situations. So let's try and look for one root meaning common to all forms of Kedusha. You might think the best place to go for a generic definition common to all applications would be the Parsha Kedoshim. And we have to look somewhere. And there in Parsha Kedoshim, Rashi says that Kedoshim Tehiyu means Purushim Tehiyu. Specifically, Havu Purushim Min Ha'arayot U'min Ha'aveira. Shekol Makom She'ata Motzei Geda Erva, Ata Motzei Kedusha. Rashi says that Kedoshim Tehiyu, the commandment to be kosh, to be kadosh, to be holy, means that you should be separated from the arayot and from avera, from sin. And the arayot, that he's the forbidden sexual relations which he's speaking about, are actually mentioned in the previous Parsha, Acharei Mot. And Rashi is saying that the definition of Kedoshim Tehiyu is to be Purushim, separate from these Arayot, which have been just mentioned and listed in Acharei Mot. And Shekol Makom She'ata Motzei Geda Erva, and every place where you find a fence or a separation from Erva, or what I will call forbidden sexual relations, that point you find Kedusha. Now, the Or HaChaim in this situation, at this point in the text, comes to tell us that the requirement to be kadosh is a continuation of the previous Parsha of Acharei Mot, except there we are given the restrictions in the negative form, as Lo Ta'aseh. But here, according to the Or HaChaim, the text is giving us an aseh, a positive commandment concerning these same arayot. But in any event, we don't have to have a broad definition. We don't, at this point, have a broad definition of Kedusha, At best, this is a definition of kedushat haguf, the kedusha of an individual. That being the idea of restriction in the area of sexual relations. And that's it. It seems. All I have to do is restrict myself from forbidden sexual relations, and I have achieved a level of kedushat haguf. Question is, can it really be that simple? We might initially try to distill three elements from Rashi's definition. Those being, number one, A, the concept of preshut, restriction or separation, B, separation from something, and C, separation for some definite end or purpose. A broader definition of kedushat haguf is offered in the Ramchal's Mesilat Yesharim. This sefer called The Path of the Just in English, in this sefer he bases his entire work on one passage from the Talmud. He quotes Rabbi Pinchas Bar Yair, who outlines the necessary stages leading to Kedusha. Briefly, the paragraph goes like this: Torah mevi'a lidei zehirut, zehirut mevi'a lidei zerizut, zerizut mevi'a lidei nekiut, nekiut mevi'a lidei preshut, preshut mevi'a lidei tahara, tahara mevi'a lidei chasidut, chasidut mevi'a lidei anava, anava mevi'a lidei yirat chet, yirat chet mevi'a lidei kedusha. And then he has two more stages: kedusha mevi'a lidei ruach hakodesh, ruach hakodesh mevi'a lidei techiyat hametim. So we have eight stages, and then the ninth stage being kedusha, and these are all technical terms: zehirut, zerizut, nekiut, preshut, tahara, chasidut, anava, yirat chet, kedusha. Different stages in spiritual development, according to the Ramchal. And it's interesting to note that here the Ramchal can devote from 2 to 4 chapters to any one of these stages, but when he gets to the final stage, the ninth stage of Kedusha, he's got just one very short chapter, just a couple of pages. Furthermore, he doesn't really have a chapter on Ruach HaKodesh, or Techiyat HaMetim. He points out in his sefer that Ruach HaKodesh is not something that somebody can on their own develop, but it has to be bestowed upon him by Hashem. So no matter how great a Talmud Chacham you might become, you still may not reach the level of Ruach HaKodesh, because that's almost the option of Hashem to bestow it upon whom he thinks is worthy, or on who he thinks is worthy, maybe based upon the generation and whether that generation deserves somebody in its midst with Ruach HaKodesh. In any event, in the final chapter, the Ramchal clearly states what assists one towards the acquisition of this trait of Kedusha is much solitude and separation, which by eliminating the claims upon a person allows his soul to grow in strength and to unite itself with the Creator. So again, using the words of the Ramchal, we have three stages. We have preshut or separation from worldly claims on a person in order to unite with the Creator. So one is preshut. Two is preshut from worldly claims, and three, the purpose of the preshut is in order to unite with the Creator. So much for our brief treatment of Kedushat HaGuf. As for Kedushat HaZman, we are all familiar with the passage from Parsha Yitro in Shemot, which is quoted in Kiddush Rabbah, which we cite Shabbat morning after davening. Zachor et yom haShabbat l'kadsho. Ki sheshit yomim asa Hashem et haShemayim v'et haAretz et haYam v'et kol haShabam. V'yanach b'yom haShvi'i al kein beirach Hashem et yom haShabbat v'yakadshehu. Pasuk says, remember the Shabbos in order to sanctify it, because in 6 days Hashem made the heavens and the earth and the sea, and everything that is in it, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Hashem blessed the Sabbath day and he sanctified it. So then, here we have a statement of bracha and sanctification. Al kein beirach Hashem et yom haShabbat v'yikad shehu. Rashi tells us, you know, we want to know what we mean by kedusha. So we look in Rashi to see if he can give us any clarification of what these terms mean, both bracha and kedusha. So Rashi tells us that bracha, the bracha is that two portions of man per person fell on Friday. And furthermore, that the Shabbat was sanctified by the man in that it did not appear. That's Rashi's explanation. So is that it? The idea of Kedusha, according to Rashi, is simply the cessation of man. Rashi, the commentator of all commentators, but you know, I just don't understand. I mentioned to the audience yesterday that from the very beginning, since I got married, since we were married 25 years ago, I always had trouble with Rashi. He was so detailed, so picayune, as it were, to my mind at the time. I wanted philosophy, he gave me details. I wanted universal principles, Rashi gave me grammar. Nevertheless, just because you are not satisfied with an answer that Rashi gives you on a particular pasuk, you don't abandon Rashi so quickly. So, if you look in Parsha Bereishit, you realize that this Parsha here in Yitro is really an echo of an earlier Parsha there in Bereishit. That's the part that we say on Friday night, in Friday night's Kiddush. Vayavorach Elokim et Yom HaShvi'i vayakadesh oto, ki vo Shabbat mikol melach Torah asher bara Elokim la'asot. God blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified it, because on that day he rested from all of his work which he created in order to do. That's a literal translation of the words. But obviously here we are dealing with Ma'aseh Bereishit. We are dealing here in Parsha Bereishis for sure with Hashem's creation of the universe. So let's look again at Rashi and see what he says on this pasuk. Maybe we'll get a deeper meaning into the insight of what Kedushat Hazman means, and specifically what it means to be Mekadesh at Yom HaShabbat. So if you look in Rashi here in Bereishis, again he makes reference to the man, and in effect anticipates his commentary in Yitro. In effect, he says the same thing as he says in Yitro, and then he says that this passage is anticipating l'atid lavo, events that are to come later on in history. So, we're sort of back with the man, and it's a little hard to get, shall we say, cosmic significance to our understanding of what it means to be Mekadesh at Yom HaShabbat. Because I would have thought there's some great insight here that we all live for Shabbat. We go through the whole week with the idea that Shabbat is coming. We go to extreme efforts to prepare for Shabbat and to be ready for it, to follow the halachas to the nth degree. And we literally kill ourselves to be home on time for Shabbat. The whole week revolves around it. Therefore, I would have wanted some more dramatic perush explanation from Rashi as to the concept of Kedushat Hazman as applied to Shabbos. So, after thinking about this for a while, and puzzling over it, I called my Rebbe, Rabbi J. Miller. We spoke a while, and he gave me an interesting idea. That indeed, there is a great and cosmic insight that Rashi is teaching us. And that is that when Am Yisrael lived in the desert in Midbar Sinai, and this was the generation that came out of Egypt, the man fell for each of 6 days. And they simply went out into the Midbar and collected it. And furthermore, on the sixth day, there was twice as much man as on all other days. And they collected double, twice the normal amount. And if you didn't believe it, then you only took one portion and you came back the next day, there wasn't any man on Shabbat. And probably anybody who didn't follow the rules at the time, they found out pretty quickly that on Friday you had to collect twice. You had to have enough man for Friday's meals, and you had to have enough man for Saturday's meals. And this pattern, if you will, continued for 40 years. That means the Dor HaMidbar, approximately, we guess, 2 or 3 million people living there in the desert, experienced this man falling on a weekly cycle for 40 years. On 5 days, they all got one portion. On 6 days, they all got two portions. On the seventh day, on Shabbat, there was no man at all. But this was not just a routine. It meant that every week, Am Yisrael was re-experiencing Ma'asei Bereshit, as it were. Because here, who is doing the work? Hashem is dropping the man on Am Yisrael. And on Friday, he's delivering two portions. It's as if somebody, you know, in the supermarket would deliver your Friday groceries. You had enough for Friday and for Shabbos. So it says in Parsha Bereshit that for 6 days Hashem labored. On the seventh day he ceased from his work. And then it repeats the statement in Parshat Yitro. The two are obviously connected. One's a repetition of the other. What greater testimony can there be to Hashem's creation of the universe than watching the man fall every 6 days and then ceasing on the Shabbat? And at the end of the 40 years period, the cycle stops completely. That was the Dor HaMidbar. This Dor experienced for 40 years a reenactment, as it were, a display of Ma'aseh Bereshit itself. What a way to learn the lesson of Kedushat HaZman. But again, with Kedushat HaZman, we're going to break it up into our threefold framework. Number one, we have restrictions. And number two, we have restrictions from the 39 Isurei Malacha, the forbidden Malachot that are forbidden on Shabbat. And number three, these restrictions are set up in order for the individual to be able to achieve a higher level of Kedusha, a closeness to Hashem that perhaps is not available during the week. Finally, we come to Kedushat HaMakom. The Torah told us about Kedushat HaGuf in Parshat Kedoshim, with the words Kedoshim to you. The Torah told us about Kedushat HaZman in at least two places, Parshat Bereshit and Parshat Yitro. In Parshat Bereshit, we had V'yavarech Elokim et Yom HaShavi'i V'yakadesh Oto. And in Parsha Yitro, we had Al Kein Beirach Hashem et Yom HaShabbat V'yakadshehu. But now, where are we to go to find Kedushat HaAretz, the concept of the Kedusha of the land? So it was suggested that why don't we go back to Sefer Shemos, where Hashem is talking to Moshe, and Hashem you know, at the incident of the burning bush, and Hashem says to Moshe, "Vayomer, al tikrav halom, shal na'alecha mi'al raglecha ki makom asher ata omed alav admat kodeshu." Hashem says to Moshe, "Draw not, do not come close. Rather, take off your shoes from your feet, for the place whereon you are standing is holy ground." So that was one suggestion. Another suggestion is that we go back all the way back to Yaakov Avinu in Sefer Bereshit in Parsha Vayetze, where he has his dream of the famous ladder, and then when he wakes up, Vayira, and he was afraid, Vayomar, and he said, "Ma no ra hamakom hazeh, ein zeh ki im beit Elokim, v'zeh sha'ar hashamayim." And he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid, and he said, "How full of awe is this place. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Well, I think these are good suggestions, but I think to reach back to the original concept of Kedushat HaAretz that we're looking for, we have to go back to Avraham Avinu. And indeed, this is what Chazal does. And there are three phrases that I want to point out to you. We have Hashem speaking to Avraham Avinu. And in the first phrase, he says, "Lazar'acha attain et ha'aretz hazot." Hashem says to Avraham, "To your seed I am giving this land." And then Hashem says, "Ani Hashem asher hoseiti cha me'ur kasdim letet lecha et ha'aretz hazot l'rishta." I am Hashem who have taken you out from Ur Kasdim to give you this land as an inheritance. And in response to this promise, Avraham asks Hashem, "B'ma edaki irashena? How do I know that I will inherit this land?" So here Hashem makes the Brit Bein HaBetarim, a special covenant with Avraham, involving the cutting of animals and placing them in a certain sequence. And after describing that four generations of Abraham's descendants will be exiled, then the Torah states, "Vayomahu karat Hashem et Avraham brit lemur." On that day, Hashem made a covenant with Avraham, saying, "Lizar acha netati et haaretz hazot, to your seed I have given this land, minaha Mitzrayim ad hanahar hagadol nahar prat, from the river of Mitzrayim until the great river, the Euphrates River." Now, you will notice that among these three statements that I quoted from Hashem talking to Avraham, in the first one, "Lazaracha attain et haaretz hazot," the verb attain is future tense. "To your seed I will give this land." And then the second statement, "Ani Hashem asher hoseiticha me'or kasdim latet lecha." I am Hashem who have taken you out of Ur Kasdim in order to give you. Latet lecha, it's the infinitive. Latet. So it sort of comes out like a future tense. I've taken you out of Ur Kasdim in order to give you this land, but I didn't do it yet. Finally, after Avraham pushes Hashem and he says, "But me'eda, how will I know ki irishena, that I will inherit the land?" So then Hashem responds with the answer, "Lazaracha netati et haaretz hazot," to your seed I have given this land. Now we have the past tense. The words of Hashem is, it's as if it were done already. I've given you over this land. Consider it done. This is the source, the biblical source, of the original Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. This is the inherent Kedusha which resides with the land regardless of what happens in history. whether Bnei Yisrael are in the land or Chas v'Shalom are exiled and not in the land. Nevertheless, I, Hashem, have set up a restriction. I have given the land of Eretz Yisrael to Bnei Yisrael and not to the Keni, the Kenizi, the Kadmoni, the Fiti, the Prizi, the Rephaim, the Amori, the Kanaani, the Girgashi, or the Yebusi, or to anyone else for that matter. Not to the Crusaders, that's for sure. No other nation will be able to settle the land and live there for any significant amount of time. Ki li kol ha'aretz, Hashem says in Sefer Shemos. The entire world belongs to me. And therefore, I, Hashem, will give the land to whoever I want, as Rashi says at the very beginning of Sefer Bereishit. And what is the land restricted for? For you, for Am Yisrael. Atem tiyu li mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You're going to be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You're going to live in a special place and conduct yourselves on a national level in a special way. You'll be a kingdom of priests. You'll be a holy nation. Now, you may not be able to hold an Olympics there, in that holy land. But when you build my house, HaBeit HaMikdash, V'asuli Mikdash V'shechanti B'tocho, we read this morning, in today's Parsha. And then you know what's going to happen? The entire world is going to come to Yerushalayim. Not for the Olympics. What are they going to do there? So the Navi Zechariah tells us at the end of his Sefer, V'haya kol hanota mikol hagoyim habaim al Yerushalayim, V'alu midei shana b'shana, Lehishtachavot lemelech adoshem tzibakot, Lachog et chag hasukot. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations that came up against Jerusalem in order to destroy it, everyone who is left shall now go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to observe Sukkot. It's interesting to note that during the holiday of Sukkot, originally when the Beit HaMikdash was standing, we brought 70 korbanot, for the 70 nations of the world. We also know that both in Sefer Malachim and during the time of the First Temple and also during the Second Temple, that non-Jews, people from other lands, did come and offer up sacrifices at the Beit HaMikdash. So it's not unusual to think of it as a central place of assembly, indeed, perhaps for the entire world. And this is what the Navi Zechariah predicts. In any event, the intrinsic Kedusha which has originated in the Brit Bein HaBetarim, this intrinsic Kedusha will never change. This Kedusha of the entire land within its borders, as described in Sefer Bereishit, from Naha Mitzrayim to Naha Prat, its purity, its elevation for life and for death, it's remaining in the category of Nachalat Hashem. This did not change during the exile in Babylon, and it has not changed even unto this day. It's an eternal Kedusha, and it will never change. However, there is a second level of Kedusha, which is dependent upon Am Yisrael. Now, there is an analogy here between Kedushat Hamakom and Kedushat Hazman, because I'm sure you all well know the difference between Shabbat and Yom Tov, and the difference between them is reflected in the different brachot which we make. On Shabbos in Shmona Esrei we say Mekadesh Shabbat, you God who sanctify the Shabbat, as distinguished from the bracha that we make on Yom Tov, which is Mekadesh Yisrael V'hazmanim, you Hashem, who sanctify Israel and the holy periods, the holy times. The Torah tells us that HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem, this month will be to you. That means that the members of Knesset Yisrael, will make a determination as to when Rosh Chodesh occurs and when, in fact, it will be Yom Tov. Whereas the Kedusha of Shabbat is not dependent on our actions, it's Kavua V'Kaimei, as the Yerushalmi says. So, nevertheless, when it comes to Yom Tov, that's determined by Beis Din, acting on behalf of Am Yisrael and Klal Yisrael. They determine when Rosh Chodesh comes out, and in effect, they determine when Yom Tov falls out. Now, in parallel fashion, when Am Yisrael entered Eretz Yisrael under Yehoshua, and then they conquered the land, and then divided the land, and then settled on the land, this entire process was called by our Rabbanim the Kedusha Rishona, where Am Yisrael itself is Mekadesh Haaretz. Their settling the land is an act of sanctification of the land. Haaretz nitkadsha l'mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz. The land became sanctified for the purpose of observing the mitzvot that were dependent upon living in the land of Israel. And this is what the Mishnah in Kelim tells us. Esek du shotein. Eretz Yisrael mekudeshet mikol ha'aratzot. Umahi kedushata. Shemeviyim mimena ha'oma ha'bikurim ushtei ha'lechem. Ma she'ein kein mikol ha'aratzot. There are 10 levels or degrees of holiness. And the land of Israel is holier than all other lands. And what constitutes its holiness? In that they bring the omer, the first fruits, and the two loaves from the land, which they cannot bring from any other land. Meaningly, that when they bring the omer, or the first fruits, or the two loaves, that produce must come from the land of Israel. They can't import it anywhere else in order to offer it up in the sanctuary. So following our model for Kedusha, we have Eretz Yisrael and not Bavel. We have Eretz Yisrael and not Syria. We have Eretz Yisrael and not the United States. On the positive side, the restriction is for what? For the bringing of the Omer, the Bikurim, and the Shtei HaLechem, which are not brought from any other land. Therefore, our threefold structure of trying to understand the concept of Kedusha still maintains itself. We have pre-shoot from something for some definite end or purpose. When Rov Bnei Yisrael live in Eretz Yisrael, then the obligation to observe the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, those mitzvot dependent upon our being in the land of Israel, is activated. And again, these are the bringing of the Omer, the bringing of the Bikurim, and the offering of the Shtei HaLechem, the two challahs in the Mikdash. And these are mitzvot which are not done anywheres outside of the land of Israel. Now, in the Gemara Chulin, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua is cited as holding that when we lost the land during Chorban Bayit Rishon, then Kedusha Rishona Kitsha L'Sha'ata V'lo Kitsha L'Atid Lavo. He says that this Kedusha Rishona was a Kedusha that was activated at that time, but it was not a Kedusha for all times. And that when the Chorban Bayit Rishon occurred under the Babylonians, then that this Kedusha Rishona ceased from existing. But elsewhere, Rabbi Yishmael ben Yossi in the Gemara Erechen says that Shekedusha Rishona, Kedusha L'Sha'ata V'Kedusha La'atid Lavo. This Kedusha Rishona was in effect at the time of Yehoshua and onward, and will always be in effect. And the issue was argued back and forth. In fact, we paskin like the Rambam that Kedusha Rishona Batla, that this original Kedusha is Batel, was nullified by the destruction of the second temple. But you should know that the Ravid takes exception to this conclusion, and we need to investigate the matter more carefully. In any event, when the Jews left Babel, when they left Babylonia under Ezra and returned to Eretz Yisrael, the land was sanctified a second time, and this is called HaKadusha Shnia. This Kedusha, this second Kedusha, comes not by an act of conquest, of kibush, but al yedei chazaka. Chazaka being a technical term, meaning taking possession, taking hold of, and settling the land. And simply by their settling on the land and being there, they came to own it and sanctify the land. This second Kedusha instituted under Ezra once again activated the obligation to observe the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, those mitzvot which are dependent upon our being in the land of Israel. Again, the bringing of the Omer, the bringing of the Bikurim, the offering of the Shteil Lechem, and you could even include, which I didn't mention before, but certainly I've been including them in thinking to include them, which would be Maser, Truma and Maser. The question is whether these mitzvot hatriyot ba'aretz, under the Kedusha Shnia, the second institution of or sanctification of the land under Ezra, whether these mitzvot were deraita or derabbanan, whether they were Torah obligations or rabbinical obligations, and whether even today whether they are deraita or derabbanan. It's a long and complex discussion, but nevertheless, I'm not going to go further with it, but simply to lay it on the table to let you know that it exists. But I want to go further, because this previous discussion should now serve to clarify a very mystifying assertion, both in the Torah and on the part of Chazal. Because it says in the Torah in Vayikra, Ani Hashem Elokechem asher hotzeiti etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim letet lechem et eretz Kana'an liot lechem l'elokim. I am Hashem who have taken you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Kana'an in order to be your God. So it's a very strange statement. That means you, Hashem, were not our God when we were in Egypt. So I looked for some clarification of this, and I went to Rashi, who quotes the Gemara in Ketuvot, Kuf Yud, where Rashi says, Shekol hadar be'eretz Yisrael, ani lo lelokim. Anyone who lives in Eretz Yisrael, I am his God. V'chol hayotzei mimena, anyone who leaves Eretz Yisrael, ki oved avodah zarah. It's as if he were an idol worshipper. But what a strange assertion. This just makes the Torah pasuk that I quoted even harder. The Torah said, I am Hashem who took you out of Egypt in order to be your God. Once I give you the land of Canaan. I'm giving you the land of Canaan in order to be your God. It seems to say that I'm not your God in Egypt. And then the pasuk, the quotation that Rashi gives us from Ketuvot seems to say, everybody who lives in Eretz Yisrael, then God is God to them. But anybody who leaves Eretz Yisrael, it's as if they are idol worshippers. It's very strange. That means that Rashi and the Rambam and Baalei Tosafot, in fact, all the Rishonim and Acharonim living in Europe and North Africa should be compared with idol worshippers? If you told me, you know, non-religious people, those engaged in maybe disreputable professions or those who didn't send their children to Talmud Torah, give me a criterion that I can understand. But you're giving me just a geographic criterion. And certainly it puts all of us in the diaspora in a very bad situation. Nevertheless, I think the appropriate question here, to rather than just to toss out the Chazal and to say either I don't understand it or it doesn't make sense, I think we have to ask, what does it mean to have a God? In other words, I don't want you to just to tell me that you believe there is a God who created the heavens and the earth, or that even that you, I don't know, that you feel close with God, that you have a relationship with God. But what does it mean, even beyond the stage of belief, to say that you have a God? And in our discussion last night, I got various responses for this. I really think if you have a minute to turn the tape off and think about it, come up with your own answer, and then compare it with the answer that I'm going to offer up. Because I think the answer relates to what we say on Rosh Hashanah when we compare Hashem to a melech. And if you'll recall, we change all of the davening, a great deal of the davening, in Shmona Esrei, even in the days before Rosh Hashanah, talking about HaMelech HaKadosh instead of HaKel HaKadosh. We refer to God as the King. And it's very prominent in the days of Slichas approaching Rosh Hashanah. It's certainly very prominent during Rosh Hashanah. So let's ask this question. What does it mean to say you have a king? I might even say I distinguish a king from a dictator. A tyrant is a tyrant. A tyrant isn't a king. A tyrant is ruling by force, by fear, by threats. But the Jewish concept of a king has got to be something very different. It's got to be... There's a Rabbeinu Bachaye that says there is no king without a people. And in fact, we might want to generalize the idea from melech to malchut. And malchut is a concept, not a person. The Zohar goes as far as to say that a king has no personal existence at all. So for the sake of simplicity, let's say that in order to be a king, you have to be freely and willingly accepted by the people. It has to be a mutual relationship in which the king consents to be the king and the people consent to accept the king. But then, if they accept the king, what are they going to do? Are they going to obey some of his commandments and not others? Are they going to pick and choose? Is that going to make him a king? Or if they're going to make him a king, then they're going to accept his rulership over them in all aspects and phases of their existence. Likewise, in respect to Hashem, if you're not in Eretz Yisrael, and if Rov Am B'nei Yisrael are not in Israel, if the majority of Jews are not in Israel, then you can't do all the commandments of the king. You can't do the mitzvot ha'tuliot ba'aretz. Can't? So that's why Chazal says ki'ilu. It's not that you won't do the mitzvot. If you could, you would. You're not idol worshippers, but it's almost as if you were. You can't keep the commandments of the king. V'asitam et kol mitzvatai, Hashem says. And we quote this every day in the Shema. You're in Chutz La'aretz and you can't keep all of my mitzvot? Then it's as if you were an idol worshipper. The conclusion may sound a bit harsh, certainly to us living in Chutz La'aretz, but I do think it's an accurate understanding of the intent when the Torah says, "In Vayikra Ani Hashem Elokechem, Asher Otzeiti Etchem Eretz Mitzrayim Letet Lechem Et Eretz Kanaan Liot Lechem Lelokim." Again, I am Hashem who took you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan in order to be your king. So then at this point in the talk, I addressed my remarks to Baylor again, and I told her that when you go to Eretz Yisrael next year, God willing, that I hope you remember these words. You're going to Israel because that's where the Shekhinah is, and that's where Am Yisrael should be. And when you paint, I want you, Bela, to remember that you're in the presence of the Shekhinah. Remember you had a grandfather, Alav HaShalom, who yearned to be in the land of Israel and actively taught his children that they had to move there. And two out of three did. And when you remember all of this, then, Bela, I want you to paint me a picture of Yerushalayim. Remember that this is a land, it's an Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Darashota, Tamid Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba. In Sefer Devarim, it says that Hashem is always looking after Eretz Yisrael. His eyes are always on the land, and he's always inquiring into the welfare of Eretz Yisrael. And on this, the Tanchuma says, Ve'ein Hashchina Shoreh Ela Be'Eretz Yisrael, that the Shekhinah only dwells in the land of Israel. Thank you.